Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to welcome you on behalf of the LaRouche PAC. My name is Deborah Freeman. I serve as Mr. LaRouche's national spokeswoman and his representative here in Washington. We are going to be getting today's event underway in just a moment. We're bringing people in, and we'd like to make sure that everyone is seated before we start, because we do, in fact, have a very special treat for our audiences today. As always, we have audiences gathered here in Washington, but all over the world. And a little bit later on, I will give you an idea of where some of those gatherings take place. But this is truly an international event. As always, for those of you who are listening via the internet, as Mr. LaRouche speaks, if you have questions that you'd like to submit, you can email your questions in. I will vary the questions. We have some questions from institutions here in Washington. We have some questions from institutions around the world. We have questions from our audience here. And we also have the questions that you all will email in. And I will try to take each question in turn. As always, I do sometimes group questions together because Mr. LaRouche's presentations often provoke similar questions on different topics. I think there's really no question that today's event takes place in a much happier environment than events in the past may have. And I hope everyone is happy, because happy people work harder. And we have a great deal of work to do. So if everyone now will take their seats, we're going to close the doors for the next part of the presentation. And then I'll come back. And when I come back, we'll open the doors again. But right now, I'd like to bring Mr. LaRouche up here. And he'll introduce the next part of the program. Lynn?
Thank you. Thank you. As you will understand better, I think, in the course of the next 3 hours, that what the subject we have to address now is of momentous world importance, and you will appreciate better later as we get into the discussion, that the moments which in past history of European civilization, which correspond to what we're going through now, should remind us of 1648, the Treaty of Westphalia, whereas over a period from 1492 with the beginning of the expulsion of Jews from Spain to the Treaty of Westphalia, the question of European civilization, existence as civilization, was in doubt, as today. Similarly, in the middle of the 14th century, Europe was plunged into a dark age after centuries of cruelty under the Norman-Venetian tyranny. So in 1648 and immediately afterward, Germany in particular, as the center of the great conflict of the Thirty Years' War, rejoiced in liberation from religious warfare through the Treaty of Westphalia. This is comparable to the great terror which threatens us today, is a monetary crisis like that of the middle of the 14th century, the so-called New Dark Age crisis. Today, at this time, as it will become clearer not only from today's discussion, but from the events which are about to occur on a global scale, you're living in one of the most terrifying periods of history known to you. Now, right now. In this circumstance, in the rejoicing from the liberation of religious warfare, in Germany, around Lutherans of all things, a hymn was developed called Jesu meine Freude. Later, in the course of the early 18th century, Johann Sebastian Bach reset and treated this as the greatest of his several motets. Today, we're going to have a performance of it to begin this in celebration of the kind of the great moment of history which we're trying to bring forth again on this planet in this time of great danger. Unfortunately, we're in a hotel where the acoustics are not those you would get in a good church and so forth. So you will not get the full beauty of the performance because it doesn't fit these walls. But with a little stretch of the imagination and some good hearing and some insight into music, you will appreciate what they're about to do. And after you hear them sing, I'll get back to you.
sein nicht gleich wie Sonnengott.
Ihr Abend sei nicht gleich wie Sonnengott.
Ihr Abend sei nicht
gleich wie
Sonnenfrau,
ist nicht,
ihr Abend seid nicht gleich wie Sonnenfrau, ist nicht, ihr Abend seid nicht gleich wie Sonnenfrau, ist nicht, ihr Abend seid nicht gleich wie Sonnenfrau, ist nicht, ihr Abend seid nicht gleich wie Sonnenfrau, ist nicht, ihr Abend seid nicht gleich wie Sonnenfrau, ist nicht, ihr Abend seid nicht gleich wie Sonnenfrau, ist nicht, ihr Abend seid nicht gleich wie Sonnenfrau, ist nicht, ihr Abend seid nicht gleich wie Sonnenfrau, ist nicht, ihr Abend seid nicht gleich wie Sonnenfrau, ist nicht, ihr Abend seid nicht gleich wie Sonnenfrau, ist nicht, ihr Abend seid nicht gleich wie Sonnenfrau, ist nicht, ihr Abend seid nicht gle
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, please just stay seated. They're going to set up the stage, and it'll just take a moment. Do I need this? Okay. Somebody want to take this? Once again, let me welcome you to today's event. Certainly after the last few weeks of this campaign, it's with a certain amount of pleasure that we can say that the Democrats now control both houses of the U.S. Congress, and I think that there is broad recognition, both here in Washington and across the United States, that that victory was in fact sparked by Mr. LaRouche and by the youth movement that is associated with him. Because in fact, the Democratic Party itself was not in the greatest shape during the course of this spring when the campaign really did take off in earnest. The situation now in Washington is an interesting one, because for many of us who work here and who represent Mr. LaRouche, we've listened to our Democratic colleagues on Capitol Hill tell us for months that they agree with Mr. LaRouche and that they absolutely agree with Mr. LaRouche's economic policy. But the only problem, you see, is that we Democrats are not the majority party. And what would be the point of introducing this legislation? The Republicans would just strike it down. And we've heard that refrain over and over and over again. But now, the Democrats are in control. So there's really no reason at all why we can't expect that they will, in short order, introduce all of this legislation, and we can get on to the important tasks at hand. And it actually, and I'm not being facetious, it's my full expectation that is, in fact, the way we will start the new year, because it's the way we must start the new year. The fact is that the Democratic victory is an important one. But now that the election is over, we also have to face the simple reality that the onrushing strategic, financial, and economic collapse will accelerate. And now the question on the table is not a question of who will run for president in 2008. The question on the table is how, in fact, the American people and this nation are going to organize their way out of the great crash of 2007. And there is no better person to address that than Lyndon LaRouche. Please join me in welcoming him.
Thank you, young lady. Thank you. Just to start with a few observations, our subject will essentially be the question of the economy as such, which requires a lot of attention. We'll get more attention. I will be producing this weekend for publication over the weekend in EIR and in other publications a study of the U.S. economy and how to save the U.S. economy, the title Saving the U.S. Economy. It will cover some of the same area that I'm addressing here today, but it's a more in-depth treatment of the type due to an audience for written publication as opposed to an oral presentation. And there are some things which I shall say here, should I not say then, there, because this is an oral occasion for a discussion, an oral discussion between me and people out there and people here. So that's a different kind of communication than speaking to a written, or writing to a written audience. Now, there are three subjects which I would call to your attention as reference, and then I shall return to the one, which is the economy. First of all, you may know that Bob Rubin, the former Secretary of the Treasury, made some remarks recently, and some other people made similar remarks, but he in particular, in which he did not exactly go all the way, but he did warn that we're facing an immediate crisis, an immediate collapse of the present monetary financial system, which he has been saying for some time. He did not propose the remedies for this, but it simply indicated the need to address the reality of the threat, which he much understated. But I don't object to that, because Bob Rubin is committed to two things. He's a professional in the banking field, which is his basis for being Secretary of the Treasury. He's a very bright person, very intelligent, and very courageous. But he is a banker, not a politician. He's not a commander of a field army. I'm more inclined to the latter profession, as you know. But I agree with him on this point, that he is what he is, and I am what I am. And I have no objection to the fact that he's greatly understating the problem and not identifying the solution, even to the degree that he does have a solution. Because his job is to move things forward, to get people off their butts, so to speak, to recognize that there is not a happy economy out there. There is a terrible economy in which the lower 80%, even the lower 90% of family income brackets of the United States in particular, are suffering greatly, in which every nation state of continental Western and Central Europe is in the process of disintegration, in which there is some recovery in some parts of South America, but the extent of misery is massive. The situation in Africa is unspeakable. And if the United States goes down, as I shall explain, in that case, China will go down, India will go down, and the rest of the entire world will go down. Go down in a chain reaction, not into a depression, but into a general breakdown crisis comparable to what happened to Europe in the middle of the 14th century, a period which became known as the New Dark Age, which half of the municipalities of Europe disappeared from the map and one-third of the level of population in a period of one generation. We're now facing a condition which potentially threatens that on a global scale. So I don't object to what Bob said, because his job is to try to move some deadheads to life, to realize that this is not a happy situation, that we're in a very deadly situation which requires rather strong and exceptional remedies. Fortunately, those remedies exist if we have the will to adopt them. You have a similar kind of situation around the Iraq withdrawal issue. Now, we are all committed to the Iraq withdrawal, I presume, but there are practical problems in executing the withdrawal. So therefore, we have to be concerned that there is a serious commitment to getting out of there, that it's not a baby commitment, it's not an if commitment, it's an absolute commitment. But we are not going to simply leave the place. Therefore, as generals have said, leading generals who have opposed the war have made the same observation. You have to adopt a process by which you successfully disengage and don't increase the mess which already exists created by the Bush administration and its policies. So therefore, I agree with both those of us who say immediate withdrawal, but who also say we've got to have a scheme for withdrawal which fits the requirement. There's another question of the same nature. Some Democrats are not saying impeachment if they're in the Congress. Why? They're for impeachment. We are for impeachment. But why are they saying that, apart from the deadheads? Like, we have a Democratic deadhead. He's called Lieberman from Connecticut. He was elected by the Republican Party, and he's called a Democrat. But in general, they're right. Why? Because, as they will tell you, as Conyers, for example, who's the head of the relevant incoming committee of the Congress, will tell you that when you are putting the president on trial, where you have to be a judge and jury, you cannot be a prosecutor from the outset. You must conduct the proper procedure because you cannot destroy law itself and due process in the process of seeking to accomplish something which is even necessary. However, we, who are not in the Congress, who are not in the Senate, who are not in the House of Representatives, have the responsibility to press for the impeachments we know are necessary, Cheney number one. So therefore, we press, they process. And as long as their processing corresponds to our pressing, we're going to come out just about all right. This is the nature of the function of leadership and function and process in government. If you must have a strategic outlook as to what must be done, an understanding of the problem to be corrected, but you must also have respect for the process, so that in the process of getting to where you want to get to, you don't destroy your destination. So therefore, I speak as I do, and it's my job to do so. I'm the tough guy. They're the soft guys. They speak softly, I speak toughly. Now, there's another reason, which I'll return to, the main point here today, is that Bob Rubin doesn't have a solution. None of the well-meaning leading financial authorities and economic authorities in the United States or in Western Europe or in the world at large have any conception of how to solve the presently onrushing international financial, monetary, and physical crisis. None. I do. Now, in this case, therefore, it is my job to state frankly what that solution is and to identify the nature of the problem which this remedy, this medicine, is to be applied in order to cure the sick patient. If we don't do what I know we have to do, if we don't take some of the necessary steps, then in the attempt to deal with the crisis, we'll make the mess worse. And if we make the mess worse now, in a crisis which is far more serious than the 1929-1933 period, if we do that, we get a dark age. So therefore, action must be taken now, decision must be made now, the medicine must be the right medicine, the solution, the plan must be the right plan, and we can get out alive and well and be free of some of the diseases that have gotten us to this point. That's my job. It's my job to say what has to be done because others don't know what is to be done. Bob Rubin doesn't know what to do, and he's about as smart as they come in the United States on this question. Nor does former President Clinton, nor do any of the leaders of the committees of the Congress, the Senate or the House. None of them know what to do. They have the intention, the best of them, of doing something. They want to know what to do. My job is to tell them what the solution is and what to do. And let's hope they agree for the sake of us all and for the future generations of humanity. Now, the present crisis is something which I warned of in particular at the end of 1995, when I was a guest of a Vatican conference on health policy questions. And during the conclusion of that session, I presented a paper in support of the proceedings, in which I specified the general nature of the crisis which we faced, in which the whole health question had to be situated. The economic aspect of how do you address the growing health situations, the deprivations which are occurring, the failure to meet the requirements from around the world. And I published this same material in the form of what I call the triple curve in January of 1996, as the launching of my then presidential primary campaign. Since that time, there's been some change. One aspect of the curve relationship changed, as I noted, around the year 2000, 1999 to 2000. But the what I said then is absolutely true. What has happened, the reality of the economy is that over the period, especially since about 1987, and the measures taken under Bush 1, Bush 41 as he's called, that a process was set into motion under a raving fascist lunatic, otherwise known as Alan Greenspan. And this process resulted in a decline in the physical income and productive output of the United States. But this decline was apparently offset by an increase in financial aggregates, because the Federal Reserve System and other mechanisms were printing money in the wildest way imaginable on the basis of so-called financial derivatives. And therefore you had a financial growth, a hyperbolic tendency in expansion of the amount of financial aggregate while the physical aggregate per capita of production was going down. In the meantime, you were driving this financial aggregate by expansion of the monetary aggregate, by new ways of creating fictitious money, which some people try to take to a bank. And every bank of those, you don't do that. You take fictitious monetary assets and you sell them to somebody sucker to get whatever you can get in terms of physical assets or negotiable assets. So now we've reached the point at which the rate of monetary expansion required to support financial expansion, to keep the whole blasted bubble from popping, or to cause it to pop, is such we're now at the fag end of the system. We've now reached the point with the collapse of production. Like, for example, the Congress did nothing. The Congress did absolutely nothing definitive during the entirety of 2005 to deal with the collapse of the auto industry. We said, change it. The federal government should bail out the auto industry by taking the sections of the auto industry which are not needed for production of automobiles and use that section for other things we do need, such fixing up the rivers, which are no longer functional, fixing up our infrastructure in general, producing new power plants, basic economic infrastructure, which is what government does well, as opposed to the private sector, and use that driver of using the high technology section of the auto and aerospace industry, which is not needed anymore for automobiles. Use that sector, keep it fully in function, because it has a machine tool capability, the ability to produce almost anything. So use that to build up our infrastructure, to expand our production in the private sector generally, and to go away from being a post-industrial society, which is another way of describing death, back into an industrial society, which means physical progress per capita per square kilometer. And all you have to do is look at the conditions of life of the lower 80%, even now the lower 90% of family income brackets in the United States, and you see that the President of the United States is, as we all suspected for some time, a raving lunatic. There's nothing true in anything he says. I mean, a president who wants to go out and kill tourists is not exactly doing something good for the United States. Now, what has to be done to get to the essence of the matter. What is the solution? Well, the first thing is don't sink the dollar. Because if the dollar is devalued today in a significant degree, say 20 or 30%, would mean the entire system, the entire world system, would go chain reaction fashion into a global dark age. Because the whole world system is dependent upon a dollar which intrinsically has no intrinsic value. The dollar has a conventional value, not a physical value. In 1971-72, we destroyed the dollar. We took it off Bretton Woods system. And we said it's floating. What does it mean, floating? You know what floats, huh? But the point was the dollar was still used as the currency of account in denomination by the International Monetary Fund. So the world system is a dollar system, despite the fact that some parts of the world are trying to disengage from heavy implication in dollars to other currencies. There's no escape either, because the entire world system is based on the ability to collect on the U.S. dollar. If you can't collect on the U.S. dollar at parity, then you are bankrupt too, every nation in the world. China goes into a crisis. India goes into collapse. Every part of the world goes into a collapse if the dollar goes down by 30%. So the first thing you have to understand is that there's no solution unless you prevent the dollar from collapsing. How can you prevent the dollar from collapsing? Well, two things have to be done. The United States government has to get rid of this president. And vice president. If you want to save your rear end, get rid of this president. And have him go where you want to put your rear end. Because unless you can make a change from his policy, and the guy's pretty stubbornly insane, unless you can do what I want to do, what Franklin Roosevelt would have done, unless you want to do that, then you are useless. You are worse than useless. You are an impediment in the wheels of progress. If I'm president of the United States, or can get somebody else who is president to do the right job, we can stop the crisis by political power. We can say we are going to defend the dollar at parity on international markets on condition that other countries will cooperate with us in doing it. So what we do is we agree to that we're going to set up a return to something like the Bretton Woods system that Nixon shut down in 1971-72. We are going to say the policy of the United States is to establish a fixed parity relationship with other currencies, other nations and currencies of the world. We're going to create a new system which will be denominated in dollars but at a fixed ratio. We are going to convert short-term obligations en masse into long-term obligations of up to 25 to 50 years by treaty agreement. And therefore, we can stabilize the world on the basis of the agreement with countries that are willing to do that. We can then, on that basis, we can issue new credit at 1 to 2% as fiat credit of governments or under treaty agreements, long-term trade and credit agreements among governments. For example, in the case between Germany and China, for a good example, because Germany is pretty much a trading partner of Russia and China. That's the key to Germany's having an economy at all. All right. So if you can, these countries have different kinds of political, economic, monetary systems. But therefore, if you have a treaty agreement covering a 25 to 50-year period at 1 to 2% simple interest rates of government to government over this period, you can now create a new vehicle of credit to finance the major projects which Asian countries in particular require, because they don't have enough facilities now to do the complete job they need to do for their own countries. So we can fix this at low rates of borrowing costs. We crank up Europe, starting with Germany, We crank them up to produce the product that agent requires, particularly for capital goods, capital investments, capital improvements. We finance the thing on a 25 to 30-year basis in bulk. We also use a reform monetary system of a Bretton Woods type, not the Bretton Woods system, but a Bretton Woods type, a fixed exchange rate system, and we lock the world up into a set of agreements for economic, physical economic recovery and growth. Now, we also do something else. The reason that this crisis is so severe is because of Alan Greenspan. That man was no good. Wherever he is today, he's still no good. And you don't know where he might have gone in the meantime, if you know anything about him. Any follower of Ayn Rand may have gone anyplace. He may be still following her, for all I know. And when you look at the Ayn Rand supporters, who've turned out to be some of the nastiest fascist types of neocons in existence on the surface of this planet, you have to know that Alan Greenspan was, as they say in Satan, no damn good. So therefore, this is the mess we have created by, instead of creating debt for investment in creating new plants, new production facilities, basic economic infrastructure, scientific and technological progress, large-scale investment in nuclear power plants, things of that sort. Instead of doing that, we have invested in gambling. How many parts of the United States have opened up casinos and legalized gambling as a substitute for tax revenue, as a world of employment? What is that worth? It's gambling. Now, where in the hell did gambling come from? So this is what we have, is we have the entire world is based on a gambling system. Hedge funds, gambling system. The banking system is bankrupt implicitly because of its tie to hedge funds. We're now getting to the point that the hedge funds are going to start collapsing one after the other by bubble pricking. We have the real estate bubble. It's a fraud. The entire real estate investment of the United States is a fraud. Right, we're standing across the river in Loudoun County. It's ground zero for the biggest financial real estate crash in all human history. It's going into a chain reaction collapse. And other parts of the country are not far behind. That's the situation we're in. It's because we have incurred a mass of debt, of financial debt, in the system based on a gambling system. And instead of being honest gamblers who accept their losses, after they've lost the money, they demand to be paid for their losses at a profit. So therefore, what we will do is simply go at this through a financial reorganization. We must save the banks. I agree with Bob Rubin on that. You must save the banking system. Why? Because of the function of the banking system in circulation of credit, deposit, and so forth, and organization of communities and private and family life, and so forth. Huh? But they're bankrupt. All right, we still save them. We put them through bankruptcy. We keep the doors open in bankruptcy. Guess where the word bankruptcy came from? From banks. So you have the federal government now moves in and takes over the bankrupt banks and says, you guys are going to keep the door open by federal order. We're taking the Federal Reserve System into receivership by the federal government, and the federal government is going to operate it. We are now going to take accounts which cannot be currently paid. We're going to put the entire system through bankruptcy reorganization. Huh? You can't close your doors. We will tell you what accounts you are allowed to pay. We'll tell you what accounts should be guaranteed, whether they're paid or not or can't. We will regulate where you can take your unpaid balances in the banks and you can draw upon them at nominal rates for your own purposes. In other words, you may have a savings or something lodged in a bank, on the bank account. The bank doesn't have the money to pay you for your investment. But we can decide by federal law that certain kinds of investments of that sort will be guaranteed, and therefore that we can negotiate that a person who cannot withdraw money from the bank because the bank doesn't have it can get a loan at minimal charges in which to use their own money until we can get to the point that we can liquidate this, as we did with the bank holiday procedure on a much milder problem back in the 1930s under Roosevelt. So therefore, we can keep the banks functioning. We can selectively protect those things which are of highest priority to the functioning of communities and families. That we can do. We will then simply take the financial derivatives and similar kinds of phony investments, and we will cancel them, write them off. They're gone anyway, so why not write them off? The banks are bankrupt. You have to settle, so much on the dollar. We may end up settling on 20 cents on the dollar for the entire banking system, in terms of financial system, in terms of assets, like that. But if we do it, we go from an unregulated situation of chaos to a regulated system. We turn short-term crisis into long-term stability. We eliminate things that should be eliminated from the accounts. We protect things that should be protected, and we enter into international agreements to expand physical production and development of infrastructure. At that point, we really don't have a problem. Because if we are keeping enough of the people of the United States working, not in McDonald's, but in actually useful things where you dare to eat, you know, in your own kitchen, you dare to eat the food most of the time, don't you? When you go to McDonald's, you wonder, what am I really eating? Who am I eating? It tastes like somebody from Australia. What's this pouch doing in my hamburger? So the problem is not insuperable. And you can look at what Franklin Roosevelt did during the 1930s and turned an economy which had collapsed by one-third under Hoover. And he turned it into the greatest economic machine the world had ever seen. A machine which was the only thing that saved the world from Hitler dictatorship was the United States and its partnership with other countries, including the Soviet Union, including an unwilling ally, Great Britain. Great Britain had been fully for Hitler. And Roosevelt and some other developments convinced some people in Britain not to go for Hitler. The leading bankers of New York City were all for Hitler. They'd been for Mussolini too. Roosevelt beat them over the head. Said, now you're against Hitler. They said, okay, yes, ma'am. They get confused on these things. So we forced these guys, who were actually the authors of the Nazi system, in the United Kingdom, among the French syndicates, among the U.S. bankers, including the granddaddy of the present president of the United States, Prescott Bush, who was a Hitler backer. He personally signed the order which moved the money into the Nazi Party as a loan, which guaranteed the non-collapse of the Nazi Party in time for Hitler to become the dictator of Germany and almost the dictator of the world. That was the granddaddy of this here president. This guy who wants to kill tourists. not good presidential material. Anyway, so the issue here is that we can, as governments, if governments agree, and you need a conspiracy among some good governments of the world, and the rest will have to go along. This comes to another question I'll get to later. But we are now involved in a general collapse where the amount of debt and the acceleration of the amount of debt, unpayable debt being paid off with more unpayable debt, is reaching the point, as typified by the housing crisis or the debt mortgage crisis in the United States. They were coming to the end of the road, as Bob Rubin says. As I said, I support Bob Rubin because he's trying to awaken some idiots in the United States to the fact that there is no prosperity, that the system is about to collapse, that we're already overripe for an immediate collapse any day, any morning, any afternoon. And once it starts, if the U.S. government and some other governments don't do the right thing, the whole world will go into a dark age. We're at that point. That's why I have to do something. Now, the problem is, a psychological problem, is people believe in money. There you have, for example, the British have a theories of money. Marx got his ideas from the British. Therefore, the Marxists have silly ideas about money. They have a theory of value about money. Money, whether in metallic or paper or in computer language form, has no intrinsic value. None. It is a medium. It's a contract. That's all. Or it's a medium of a contract. Now, especially in modern society, since medieval society, in fact, since ancient Greece, money as a notion of value has always been a characteristic of what's called imperialism. Now, in the old days, they didn't call it imperialism. In those days, they called it, in ancient Greece, for example, it was called the oligarchical system. The oligarchical system is, and this is where the problem arises inside the United States. It's where the problem arises inside the Democratic Party leadership. The oligarchical system, where you had people who were running the Democratic campaign, Howard Dean's Democratic campaign, who were looking at people like Felix Rohatyn, who is by all credentials a fascist. After all, he financed bringing Pinochet to power in Chile. That is not exactly what we consider a first-class Democrat. But they said, we're going to the upper 3% of family income brackets to finance the Democratic election campaign. I said, nonsense. They said, no, we're going to do it anyway. So the Democratic campaign organization, particularly under the Democratic Leadership Council, and under Howard Dean, was going in this direction. To get money. From whom? From the upper 3% of family income brackets. Now, what's the problem in the United States? The big problem is the lower 80% of family income brackets. Even the lower 90% these days, as some of you may have discovered. It used to be a safety valve to be in the upper 20%. Now you have to be in the upper 10% or the upper 3%. So the Democratic Party politics was oriented toward the upper 3%, because whose butt did you have to kiss to get the money in order to run your campaign? Why did some Democrats want to work with Felix Rohatyn? Because they wanted the money that he controlled. Therefore, he could dictate their politics based on their desire to please him in the way they ran the campaign. It's still a problem. We're going to have to sort it out. Whereas real politics is the lower 80% of the family income brackets. That is, in terms of physical standards of living, conditions of life, of communities in which they live. That's real politics. That's real American politics, as opposed to some European oligarchical system where you have landlords around the world. This is called the oligarchical system. A group of wealthy families run society the way that they ran Sparta, ancient Sparta, where the Helots were hunted down for pleasure by the young, you know, bad guys of the wealthy families, where the poor were persecuted and treated as animals, where society was based on treating human beings as animals. Take Canet, for example, the so-called author of the physiocratic system, who said that the wealth comes from what? From production? He didn't say that. Idiots say that. What he said was the property title, the title of nobility to property in land for mining and farming was the magical thing which produced wealth. And the people on the estate were engaged in production of mining, in agricultural production, were no different than cows, who should be fed enough straw in order to continue to produce milk and meat. But what the fruit of production, the gain in wealth, had been produced by that lazy bum with a title sitting in his estate. And it was this magical title to that estate which secreted this surplus value as well. That's the oligarchical system. That was the system of Sparta. That was the system created by the, in European history, by the Apollo cult of Delphi, which created Rome. This is what created the Roman Empire. This is what created the Byzantine Empire. This is what created the form of empire of the Middle Ages, where the Venetians were running that these bums called the Crusaders, the Norman chivalry, in running a system of persecution of Muslims. Hey, what do you know about that? Back then, the anti-Islamic movement, medieval, the Crusaders, who were not Christian, they were out to crucify everybody. And they were working for the Venetian bankers. This was the medieval system that led to the Dark Age. This was what was restored in Europe again with the fall of Constantinople, where the Venetians took power again. This is what led to the formation of the British Empire, the Anglo-Dutch liberal system, which did the same thing. They reintroduced slavery. Now again, they've reintroduced the anti-Islamic movement, have a war against Islam. Same thing all over again. So therefore, the system is to manage the planet by treating the majority of the population, the human population of the planet, as animal life, which you can cull, kill, or maintain and pet and then eat, as you do a pet cow in a barn. The oligarchical system. What it was achieved in the Renaissance was the kind of idea represented by Solon of Athens, represented by Plato. The idea of that the totality of the people contain something which is not an animal. The people contain a spiritual, intellectual power which distinguishes man from the beast. And therefore, human beings cannot be treated as animals. And society exists for the benefit of humanity, for future humanity, and future humanity is the children of all of the people living now. So therefore, real politics is not democracy. Real politics is care for the welfare of all of the people, for the benefit of future humanity. It is respect for the sovereignty of cultures, because different people have different cultural backgrounds. They can function only in terms of their language, their culture which they communicate in. Therefore, people organize themselves in language cultures or cultures of tradition. Why? Because they think in those terms. If you want to have representative government, you have to give the people the access to the system which is theirs, in which they do their thinking, which they can develop ideas. And therefore, at the same time, you must then have a fraternity among relations of different cultures in the planet. Roosevelt had such intention, Franklin Roosevelt. Truman had the opposite intention. Franklin Roosevelt's determination, as he said repeatedly, was at the end of the war, the great economic production machine, which the United States had developed to defeat Hitler, would now be converted as a source of productive power to enable the colonial nations of the world and the suppressed people of the world to develop their own government independent and to create on this planet a fraternity among national self-governments of peoples. That was Roosevelt's intention. What Truman did, Truman was a stooge for Churchill. The British did not intend to give up their empire. Truman let the British occupy their colonies again. The Truman administration gave Vietnam back to the Japanese in order to turn it over to the French. The British government and the Dutch suppressed the people of Indonesia. The cause of freedom in Africa was brutally suppressed repeatedly throughout most of the post-war period. So that's the difference between Truman and Roosevelt. That's the difference between the American system, the American constitutional system, which we created in this country. We are able to create it because we were at a distance from Europe where the oligarchy was dominant. And therefore, we were able to take the best ideas that had developed in Europe and build a culture and a nation around the best ideas of Europe, but at a safe distance from the European oligarchy. Not completely safe, but relatively safe. And that's the difference in politics. That's the issue today. You say, oh, look at what won the election. What won the election? And it's no exaggeration, as Debbie said, that our role, particularly the role of the youth movement, and what we were pushing as our policy, was crucial during the last weeks of the campaign and securing a landslide victory for the Democratic Party in the House of Representatives. Where did the votes come from that won the election in that way? Well, it came from the people between 18 and 29 years of age. Some of you people are acquainted with some people of that age group. It came also from a surge, a great surge, of the population between the age of 25 and 35. That is what won the election. This was a part of the population which the Democratic campaign had done nothing to win over. The leading policies, they'd done nothing to win it over. That's where we played a role. We pushed, and the youth pushed hard. We won the election because we sparked a reaction in the population by the methods we used here to create a mass effect. Yeah? You have a few people with ideas, you produce a mass effect, not by person-to-person conversions. No religious conversions, please. By mass effect, you spread ideas. You deploy in such a way as to spread ideas among the people. And the spreading of ideas among the people, where the ideas are attractive to them, cause them to have a better relationship to each other. And the people who develop this better relationship with each other in terms of ideas then become influential in the entire community around them. And that's what happened. We went to everybody in our campaigns in recent period. But we went especially to those in the 18 to 25 age group as the base. And we also went to those in the 25 to 35 age group. And that's exactly where we had a success. We went to other people, but we never had the success in the older generation that we had in these two sections of the population. And this is particularly true of the college-educated population, or quasi-college-educated population. You have quasi-universities today. They're called universities, but they ain't really that. So that's how we changed it. We created a mass effect. What happened? Where did we stimulate it? Well, tell me about people who are between 25 and 35. Tell me about people in the United States who are between 18 and 25. How many of them are rich? How many of them can afford a university education? How many can afford the effects of having had it? So therefore, you have two things about these two generations, or these two groups, 18 to 25 and 25 to 35. What is characteristic of them? Baby boomers are approaching the fag end of existence, and in their cases, you call it the fag end of existence, because they don't believe in the future. They believe in their pleasure. History stops with us. That's the baby boomer. Whereas people who are 18 to 25 either are going to go on drugs and kill themselves, or they're going to say, I want a society with a future. I'm going to be around here at working age for about 50 years to come. What kind of a future do I have in the coming 50 years? Can I produce children? Can I have a family? And if I try, what's going to become of them? The person who's 25 to 35 faces the same problem. I'm around. I may have, you know, 50, 40, 50 years behind of me, a working life. I want to have a family somewhere along the line. I want to have a family that can live, where the children can live. I want to look forward to grandchildren who will be in a society which is at least as good as ours and perhaps better. This is the motivation of people who have not yet reached the baby boomer age as a result of the post-war culture. Is the 68ers have no sense of the future. They didn't believe in production. They hated people they caught wearing blue shirts. So they took their own shirts off completely. Because they were using, taking in stuff. You couldn't tell what the color was. So to get rid of all shirts. So what our culture was destroyed by the what was called in Europe the Congress for Cultural Freedom. With the Truman administration, various social measures were taken, especially in the upper 20% of family income brackets, especially in suburbia, in educational systems, through television and so forth, in order to condition the population which was born after 1945 to about 1957, to condition that population to have no values, to condition them to be complete sophists. In Europe, it was called the Congress for Cultural Freedom. In the United States, the same thing was done. So the young people who went into universities in the 1960s were generally products of this cultural indoctrination, the same thing that was spread in Europe as the Congress for Cultural Freedom. And therefore, when they exploded in reaction to the fact that they were about to be drafted, they didn't explode as long as they could get exemptions from the draft by being in a university. But when the day came that the U.S. government said they could be drafted, that the exemptions, college exemptions, were cut back, they went wild. And what did they do? They demanded clothes and took them off. They demanded freedom of their mind and took drugs to destroy their minds, like LSD. They would sit up with parties where they would have parties. They would have coke, wine, and pot. And then when they had finished going to pot, they would say, this is no longer as a thrill. I want a real ride into insanity. And they would take some LSD. They were against technology. They were against production. They were against people who worked in factories. They were against farmers. They were against every system on which the welfare of the general population depends, and they called this the new freedom. And this is what happened to us. These were the baby boomers. In Europe, as in the United States, the baby boomers destroyed society. Not because they intended to destroy society, but because they themselves had been destroyed by the Truman age culture to which they were born, especially if they were in the upper 20% of family income brackets of that period. Now, that generation has been running society, and therefore leading members of the Congress, political parties, and so forth, are not exactly in the best mental condition. They have certain... and they don't really believe in anything. They believe in their pleasure. They believe in their advantage. They're looking for thrills of various forms, like getting elected or something. But they don't believe in a mission for the benefit of future humanity. They haven't got that kind of commitment. Therefore, the future of mankind rests on the shoulders of people between 18 and 35 today. Because unless they're destroyed already, and they are thinking about a future, they're thinking of the outcome of the years to come, they're looking for a meaningful life in 50 or more years to come, whether they have children or not, as we used to. In all my experience, and I go back a good ways in terms of grandparents and so forth, well over 150 years. and in terms of people I know in the family, who I didn't meet actually, go back over 200 years. So in a sense, sociologically, I'm 200 years old. And I'm working on a third, I think. But so that's the situation. This generation is what we depend upon. This generation, however, in motion, as you saw in the election result, this generation in motion will inspire even some of the deadheads of the baby boomers to come back to human life. But they won't initiate it, but they'll follow it. This is not entirely unusual in history, that you'll find that all revolutions and wars are fought by people generally, mostly between 18 and 25. All great changes in society originate within the development of people between the ages of 18 and 25. This is the way history has been run. Look at history. Look at what generation of each part, what age group and what each generation played what part in shaping history. It's been the same. I used to warn people about this. I said, you know, at the age of 27, you change your sex. Well, if you're a university student, as you're about to get your doctoral degree, suddenly your mind drops away because you don't want to destroy the perfection of what you already know by learning something new. And if you're a professor, at the age of 27, you start to teach, and you begin to repeat after me from cards, index cards, the same lecture you got, and you pass it on to the suckers in the next class to come that you're teaching. So there's a phenomenon in society where a lack of creativity in the development of the young people results from about the age of 27, 30, or so forth. That at that point, they develop a kind of the end of progress, the end of development. They may learn new things, they may acquire new skills, they may gain in effectiveness, but they're not really creative anymore. They really are not human anymore. They're sort of an animal-like version of a human being. What they've learned and conditioned to up to that time stays with them until the memory begins to fail. But they don't progress. They don't undergo personal internal revolutions in knowledge and breaking free. They tend to become stagnant. A minority is different. You have an Einstein here and there and so forth. But the majority of people in a society of our type still go stagnant at about the age of 27 to 30. And very few continue to be actually creative beyond that point. And so therefore, the key thing in society is always focus upon what leads into the 18 to 25 age group, particularly the 18 to 35 age group in our society. Focus on that. Instill creativity or a sense, an association with creativity as a normal social process in that age group. Because if you can instill that in that age group, then you have set a new direction in society into motion. And then your life means something. Because you're doing what the baby boomer generation didn't want to do. Is create their successors. History stops here with us. And after that, we don't care. So therefore, you see in precisely in these election results that. So therefore, we're coming in this time to a point where my conception of economics is crucial. What is that conception? What's the difference between man and a monkey? Bush could never tell you. His mother was never able to tell him. And if she'd been able to do so, she wouldn't have been willing to do so, because she's a very cruel person. She doesn't like children. Uses them like Kleenex tissues. The essence of the difference between human beings and the animal is creativity. It's typified by the discovery of a universal physical principle. Or what we've done with the youth movement in terms of the work of Bach, which we celebrated again today, that in classical musical composition and its performance, if properly understood as Bach understood it, and the great composers after Bach, and the great musicians, the great performers, is creative. It is not playing the note. It's playing between the notes. It's playing the passage. It's playing the interplay of voices And in this, this difference between the literal note and the music is creativity. It involves the same powers of mind applied to a social process that the scientific discovery of principle applies to an object in nature. Science and art are the same, classical art are the same. They involve exactly the same specific kind of creative mental powers. In the one case, the object is something in nature, or animals. It's human beings, it's something social. It's something in the cooperative relationship of human minds. And this is best expressed in art, in classical art. The reason when we organized the East Coast youth operation, youth movement, we had a meeting and we decided that my proposal was accepted to take Jesu meine Freude, the work we have performed here today, and to use that as the emphasis for a cultural orientation which corresponds to the same mentality in physical scientific creativity. And to develop the practice and development of this work in music, vocal music, with that in mind, as playing between the notes, or the kind of thing that John has been working with his choruses doing on the question of the comma. What does the comma mean in music? When you get to the idea of irony as the comma, as an ironical development, which distinguishes the music from the notes, is irony. Huh? It's something between the notes. It's the same thing as the irony of the infinitesimal in physical science as defined by Kepler in the discovery of universal gravitation or the organization of the solar system. Irony. Because a universal physical principle is never an object of the senses. The effect of a universal physical principle is an object of the senses, but not the principle itself. Why? Well, gravitation is as big as the universe. Now, how can you see an object which is as big as the universe? With what will you compare it? What you see is the effect of that object as it rolls over you, so to speak. Oh, there's something there. And this is reflected as something that happens, that hits you in each instant. But how big is the instant? Well, the instant is as small as you can get, and smaller. So therefore, the same thing is true in poetry. Classical poetry is true in all great art. It is not the literal, mechanical interpretation which defines the art. It's the irony. It's something between the cracks, which is universal, a universal principle. That's what defines art. That's what defines science, as Kepler defined science, as the ancient Greeks defined science, in the terms of the concept of dynamis. So therefore, the function here in economics is what? The difference between man and the ape is creativity. If a man were an ape, you wouldn't be bothered with more than a few million neighbors of that type at the most, because you couldn't sustain a larger population of apes, gorillas, chimpanzees, and so forth. Human beings, we got over 6 billion of them. How do we get that? Because of development. What kind of development? Because humanity developed in terms of art, in terms of the equivalent of science, humanity made discoveries. These discoveries were reenacted by successive generations, became part of the practice of society. Man's power in and over the universe increased. And the more individuals who expressed his power and gained it, the more prosperous and better the society was, the more powerful the society was, the more we could conquer the world around us to provide for a better standard of living for people, for future, humanity. So therefore, this is what's crucial. Now, in oligarchical society, the oligarch does not want the majority of people to understand this. It wants to reduce, like Adam Smith or the physiocrats, to degrade man to the status of being an obedient cow, and to tell himself to be happy. Tell the cow to be happy. Tell the cow to shut up and be happy. Stop that noise at night. I want to sleep. The cow's keeping me awake. Or I'll slaughter it in the morning. Right? And people are treated as cows. You're supposed to learn things. You learn how to behave. Behave as your ancestors did. Behave as you're taught in school. Don't learn a principle by yourself. Don't learn something the teacher doesn't know. You'll be thrown out of class. But that is the difference. In a society which the United States was intended to be at its inception as a nation, even before that, even in the 17th century colonies, Massachusetts Bay Colony, under that was the intention, was the development of the fullness of the creative powers of the individual, of all of the individuals, all possible individuals, to develop creativity. This creativity resulted in Massachusetts was up until 1688, where the British cracked down on it, was one of the most prosperous areas of the world. Why? Because creativity was fostered in that commonwealth at that time. It is creativity, the development of the creative powers, the nourishment of the creative powers, and the use of the creative powers of the individual, which defines the difference between man and the ape. It is also what is not understood by the people I referred to, the so-called economists. That's the secret of economy. If you develop people and develop those powers in people, if you invest in the use and promotion of those powers, their realization, then you create a population which is capable of growing in its power per capita, per square kilometer, through creativity, through the fostering of the creative powers of the individual. And that's what the oligarchy doesn't want. Now, for what happened to you? What happened is we used to be a productive United States. We had farms, we had industries, we had skilled professions and so forth. We prized these things. The more skilled professionals we had in the community, the more doctors, nurses, and so forth, all this sort of thing, the better off we were. And we knew it. But now they said, no, well, factory jobs are no good. That's what the baby boomers said. Factory jobs are no good. We take away the factory, so you won't have to slave at a factory. What do I do now? We work at McDonald's. What do you do at McDonald's? You flip hamburgers. What do you do that for? Well, I should do it at home. I don't know how to flip hamburgers at home. I don't know how to flip hamburgers at McDonald's. Never at home. So you have a degeneration of the U.S. labor force into what's called a service economy of labor-intensive, non-productive forces. The amount of product which we are producing per capita, physically, is not sufficient to maintain the existing population. We're dying. We're dying of baby boomerism. We have to go back to become a creative economy. This is what the problem is they don't understand. We have a population of the planet which is mostly very poor. The population of Asia, the population of sub-Saharan Africa is extremely poor. They don't have the power under existing conditions to maintain their existing populations safely. We need for them an improvement in not only in infrastructure, but the creation of the conditions under which their productive powers, their intellectual powers are increased, to create the conditions of development under which the power of generating their own prosperity is given back to them. And that's what these guys don't understand. They think that value lies in money, in exchange system of value. That's where the Marxists failed terribly, as in the case of the Soviet Union. The biggest characteristic of failure of the Soviet Union was the Marxist theory of value. They didn't understand that the promotion of creativity of the individual in society is the source of production of wealth, and that money is simply a means of exchange which must be created and managed to assist the process of transfer of wealth in one form or another among people. Therefore, the secret of economy lies not in management of money. The management of money is a system of slavery. where some people control the money, control the economy, for the purpose of getting more money. They do not allow development because they want to steal. They steal so much that the economy goes into negative growth, as has happened to us, as has happened to the world. They don't understand that value is a physical value, not in the sense of physical objects, but in terms of the increase of the productive powers of labor per capita and per square kilometer as a result of this process. And that's what they don't understand. That's what they don't wish to understand. That's what baby boomers don't want to understand, because they would have to admit that what they were in 1968, they were the poison that was going to destroy this society. Not because they intended to be poisoned, but because they were conditioned and brainwashed to be poisonous. They lost culture. They lost science. They lost jobs. They lost the opportunity of being productive. They lost the hope of getting health care. They lost the hope of a future for their children and grandchildren. Because they didn't understand value. They assumed that getting more money is value. But getting more money without increasing the physical powers of production has no value. It's to the extent we develop, not democracy as such, because democracy is a bad word, but freedom. The freedom of the individual is expressed by the development of the individual and the opportunity for expressing those developed powers in a useful way in society, in a way that makes you proud of being yourself, that makes you proud of what you're doing for the next generations that are coming after you. That's freedom. And the right to influence the process of thinking, which pertains to thinking in this way. And that's what they don't understand. So therefore, if we can do two things, and this election has proven it, we've proven it by the turnout by young people as voters in the 18 to 25 group and the 25 to 35 group. It proves that reposing inside the young people of America, the young adults of America, there is a core of young adults which does have an orientation toward the future, which will respond to the idea of a future, where the baby boomers generally have given up on the future and are trying to cling to what they can salvage from their own past. That's what the problem is. Therefore, the secret of making this work, what I outlined, simply reorganizing the monetary financial system, the secret is to take young people, 18 to 25, who are still open to the ideas of being useful in society, who are still open to the idea of being truly creative, who want classical art, who want science, who enjoy it, and who have a future orientation. So therefore, our purpose is two things. Define the reforms which will prevent a general bankruptcy from plunging the whole planet into a new dark age. But do that in a way which involves inspiring and mobilizing the generation between 18 and 35, which still have an orientation toward the future, at least latent within them, as they've shown in this recent election. Concentrate on them. And realize that you have to look at the lower 80% of family income brackets among these youth. Because it's not sufficient to inspire youth from the upper 20% of family income brackets. That's not enough. If you cannot inspire young people from the lower 80% of family income brackets, you do not have a future for the United States or the world. Yes, inspire everybody you can. But never lose sight of the fact that what you do for the people in the lower 80%, young people, the lower 80% of family income brackets, is what is going to determine the future of this nation and all humanity. And that is what the Democratic Party leadership has forgotten.
Okay.
Okay, before we move to the questions, let me just mention that in welcoming some of the audiences that we have around the world, I would like to mention that today's webcast is being viewed in the Mexican Congress, and we'd like to welcome them to today's webcast. There is also an audience gathered at one of at least one major university in Mexico that I know of. It's also being broadcast at four universities in three cities in Bolivia, where these webcasts are becoming something of an institution. And also in neighboring Peru, where audiences at five universities in two cities are with us today. In Colombia, the national headquarters of the Unified Labor Federation, the CUT, has invited all the trade unions around the country, which are its members, to watch the webcast and to participate in the international dialogue, and we welcome them to that dialogue. And in Argentina, two university campuses in two separate cities are with us, as well as a group in Cordoba, where the showing of LaRouche's last webcast set off a discussion in that city's print and radio media. Now, to get to some of these questions, and again, let me just mention, for those of you who are listening via the World Wide Web, you can submit your questions via email. To those of you who are here, if you have questions, please indicate your name, your affiliation, if you have one, and the nature of your question, and I will call you up to the mic. Where you can ask it. If you'd like me to read the question, then simply just write it out. To start, I think that what I will try to do, wherever possible, is to group the questions by subject, just because it lends some order to the discussion. The first question is one of strategic concern that was submitted by a group of senior retired military officers who we have been in discussion with, particularly over the course of the last week or so. And what they say is, they say, Mr. LaRouche, the Baker-Hamilton Commission report is expected to be released sometime soon. Some of us here in the United States have expressed concern that domestic political considerations could override the best overall strategic approach to the Iraq crisis, which is rapidly devolving into a sectarian civil war and worse. How would you respond to these concerns, and how would you update or modify your own 2004 doctrine for Southwest Asia?
Well, what I've not mentioned so far is who is the enemy. Now, around the world, people think the United States is the enemy. The United States is not the enemy. The United States has become a puppet of the enemy. And there are people in the United States who represent the enemy, like George P. Shultz, Henry Kissinger, and so forth. They represent the enemy, but they're not really Americans. They represent another interest, a foreign interest, which is the Anglo-Dutch liberal system. It's centered in the imperial system that wants globalization. If you wish to destroy a great nation like ours, you destroy it by first inducing it to discredit itself. And then you look at the way in which we are induced to discredit ourselves as a nation in the world. And the degree of discredit which we have suffered since the year 2000 is the greatest in our history. this presidency, this Bush-Cheney presidency, has been the instrument of our destruction, of our self-destruction, which now opens the door to the destruction by other forces besides our own. Who did it? Who was our enemy in 1776? Who was our enemy in 1812, 1815? Who was our enemy in 1861? Who has been our enemy? Who organized wars on the continent of Europe in order to build up an imperial power for a maritime power? Who did it? The Anglo-Dutch liberal forces, which have always been committed since 1763, since the Treaty of Peace of Paris of 1763, have been committed to destroying what became the United States. These are the people who have moved in and taken our presidency a number of times. These are the people who created the Confederacy. These are the people who were behind Woodrow Wilson, Teddy Roosevelt, who owned Coolidge, who owned Hoover. These are the people who owned Truman. These are the people who have owned Nixon. These are the people who owned the Trilateral Commission. These are the people who owned the right wing inside the Reagan administration, my enemies. These were the people behind George H.W. Bush. These were the people behind the Bush-Cheney government created by George P. Shultz, an accredited fascist. Who was it? The international financial oligarchy. Who is it? It's a sort of a slime mold composed of financier interests in the Venetian tradition of Paolo Sarpi, who emerged by Venetians changing their names to Dutch names and English names and so forth. They became called, instead of Venetian, they became known as Anglo-Dutch liberals. These are the people who created the British Empire, who are determined to have a world empire modeled upon the medieval model of the time that Venice, as a financier oligarchy, controlled a bunch of scumbags, to use a technical term, called the Crusaders, the Anglo-Dutch liberal, or the Norman liberals, or the Norman chivalry, who raised hell in Europe and almost destroyed civilization in the medieval period. They were reincarnated, in a sense, as the Anglo-Dutch liberals, and became a power, an imperial power, in 1763 with the Peace of Paris. Since that time, they ran wars repeatedly in order to induce continental Europe to destroy itself. They worked to destroy us in various ways. And all of our patriots from ancient times, from earlier times, knew that. Only the poor fools of today don't know that, don't know who the enemy is. Who did we fight in wars? Who was the enemy? It was always the same one. Sometimes we were the suckers, we joined the enemy. But it's the same thing today. People wish to destroy us. And we are destroying ourselves. And when the military, professional military, who are men of conscience and patriotism, react to the mess in the Middle East, so-called, they're reacting, they may not understand exactly what they're reacting to historically, because they're younger than I am. And therefore, they weren't around soon enough to find out what this thing is all about. But we patriots, look, I came back as a simple soldier from Burma into India and back here at the end of the war. And I saw us betrayed. When I hit the shore here, I knew we'd been betrayed. Betrayed by what Truman represented. In 1947, for example, I wrote a letter to Eisenhower, who was then I was president of Columbia University. And I, in a couple of paragraphs, which is what you write to a former commander of forces, I laid out the case why he must run for president for the presidential nomination on the Democratic ticket. And he wrote back and said he agreed with me, but the time was not right for him to do it. Because the patriots who went to the war understood what we were. in saving the planet. We save this planet from Nazism. No? And when Truman came in, we began, by 1948, we brought the Nazis back into positions in France and elsewhere. We put them in the jug, we talked to them for a while, and we brought them out, gave them back their old positions. And they are the force in the world today. What do you think this thing is we're dealing with in the United States is right wing? It's the same thing. But it's British methods. Remember what the British did. Here's France. Treaty of Westphalia. Treaty of Westphalia is organized by Cardinal Mazarin of France, who succeeded this idiot Richelieu, the clever idiot, but an idiot nonetheless, who had as his key man Jean-Baptiste Colbert. Organized France as the leading nation in the world. What happened to France? Why France, the leading nation in the world, the greatest power in the world at that time? What happened to it? Well, inside job. Louis XIV. And so what they did is the Anglo-Dutch liberals, our familiar friends, our ever-loving, English-speaking brothers and sisters, or English-squeaking brothers and sisters, in the case of the English. They induced this idiot, who allied himself with a bunch of gangsters called the Fronde, with imperial delusions. And he fell into a war trap with the Anglo-Dutch liberals. And there wasn't much left of the French monarchy except one little infant at the time that Louis XIV died. At that point, then, to various operations, the Anglo-Dutch liberals took over the throne of England and established it as Great Britain, British government, 1712. Leibniz dies in 1714. There's a phase change in history. More wars. Always on the continent. The Anglo-Dutch liberal system wins. Why? Take the Seven Years' War. That's how the British got to be an empire. It was the British East India Company, not the British monarchy. You had the greatest military commander of that period, Friedrich the Grosse, was very good at winning battles, but he lost the war because he was a puppet of the British in getting the forces of Russia, of Austria, Austria-Hungary, France, and so forth, all involved in this war. What comes out of it, France, who is a great power, is stripped of much of its power, and now the English have established an empire, the Anglo-Dutch liberals of the East India Company. The same thing all over again. We beat these guys. We were an inspiration in our revolution. But then what these guys did, they organized the French Revolution through the Martinist Freemasonry. And the British Freemasonry ran France. They ran the revolution. They created Napoleon. They created Napoleon? You mean, weren't they enemies of Napoleon? Yeah, not really. Because Napoleon did more to destroy continental Europe than any other single force, and then he was gone. And the same English Anglo-Dutch liberals created Hitler, and they were about to make an empire would play with him the same way by having him get stuck in the Soviet Union someplace, and they were going to jump on his ass, which is what the British like to do. And the same way, we get stuck in the same. We won World War II. We saved the planet. With all our faults, we saved this planet. Yeah, other people fought the war too. But without us, they'd have never won it. We saved the planet from Nazism. I come back from the war. Just a simple soldier. But I know what's going on. Like anybody who's intelligent knows what's going on. You come back and I find out we've been betrayed. We went over to the same crowd we fought against. Yeah, we joined the British against Hitler in order to defeat Hitler. But Roosevelt knew what the British were. He told Churchill to his face what he was. And our people forget who the enemy is. They think of the enemy in terms of some guy like as a prize fighter or something. You go out and kill somebody. The game is not to win wars by like winning prize fights. The game is, and it sometimes requires military capability, is to orchestrate history. To bring forth on this planet the kind of system of government, the system of society which we need. We were the leader of that. We were created as a leader of that because Europe was so polluted by oligarchy that even the best ideas of Europe could never succeed because of this damned oligarchy. We were independent. And after Lincoln's victory, and after Roosevelt's victory, we were repeatedly betrayed. Now, therefore, to talk about policy as in a negative way in respect to Southwest Asia is idiocy. It's not a simple military question. It's a strategic question on the highest level. We've come to the point where it's not possible to fight general warfare. You're in the age of nuclear weapons. And traditional ideas of warfare are no longer workable, except for defense in special situations. But it's the idea of general warfare, declaring warfare, going to war. You don't go to war. You may defend, but you don't continue warfare. You defend, and you seek the end of war as soon as possible. Get out of there. And you're prepared for that. But on the other side, one of the reasons you can't fight war is because we have asymmetric warfare, irregular warfare on a mass scale. We see, and no military force can stand up as a permanent occupying force against asymmetric warfare. The Israelis got their nuts kicked off them in Lebanon. Yeah, because asymmetric warfare defeated them. Yes, they bombed like hell. They bombed with air power. But what can you do? You live on the ground. You don't live in an airplane forever. What happened to the Soviet Union? In Afghanistan, asymmetric warfare. What happened to the United States and China? Asymmetric warfare. What's happened in Iraq? Aggravated asymmetric warfare. Complicated by that idiot that was put in there. When the United States had control of the situation, he disbanded the treaty agreement with the Iraqi military and the party. Under normal rules, the military rules, you would do the right thing. But Bremer did everything wrong. Accept the surrender. Adopt the forces of the country you just defeated. Have them do the job of running the country under an agreement which aims toward a peace treaty. Don't try to do regime change. It was regime change that made asymmetric warfare inevitable. We're now at the fag end of asymmetric warfare. We're losing the situation in Palestine, Israel. The situation becomes more impossible. We're about to have a Sunni-Shia war in the region. Maximum destabilization. What we have to do, therefore, is go to a higher level than simply these simple military questions. Yes, we do have to have an exit policy, but it has to be, we're going to get out of there. What that means is we're going to have to engage the entire region of Southwest Asia in a comprehensive approach to getting out of there. Now, as long as this president is in power, as the president of the United States, you can't do it. You can't do it. The generals are right in one sense, but you can't do it as long as you've got this president in there. For two reasons. Not only because of him and Cheney, and his apparatus, which is sunk too deeply already into the institutions of government of the United States. It's going to take a little work to get rid of those rats which are brought in as part of the Bush administration. They've been in there for 6 years now. They've planted their poison. They've destroyed institutions. They've destroyed ideas. They've planted their agents all over the place. The point is, the United States is not respected as long as Bush is president and as long as Cheney's influential. If the United States wants to do something in Southwest Asia, it's got to get this bum out of the White House. And it's got to have a spokesman for the United States, which people will believe. Now, I'm involved in exploring what the diplomatic options might be in part of that region. I'm personally involved in that. I've got a sense of what the situation is. And unless we can inspire the people of the region to give up the things they're planning to do right now. For example, what do we got to do? We have to go directly to negotiate not conditions with Iran. We have to negotiate a general diplomatic relationship with Iran. Period. Because once you do that, you change the dynamic. You've got to go to Turkey. and lay the thing out to them, because we are, in a sense, creating the Kurdistan problem. So we're going to get Turkey involved in this mess. We've got to cut the Israelis off on this thing. They're going to have this agreement with the Palestinians now. Period. You've got to be as tough diplomatically in these respects as you would be in warfare. If you're tough enough in the right way for the right thing, you can win the war without having to fight it. The problem is that the kind of thing that's being proposed about disengagement, the process of disengagement, is you have to have the right factors that will make it work. Right now, everything I'm reading is the situation is so damn deteriorated that merely a simple procedure like that, there's no one can do it. There's no way you can enlist forces from that region now to an agreement by which we can disengage the U.S. forces from Iraq. We're going to have to get. Now, the alternative to just getting is to do what I said. If you want to get the job done, do it. You have to change. You're dealing with a dynamic situation, not a Cartesian mechanistic situation. You've got to control the dynamics of the region. I believe we can do it. I believe we can handle it with Russia, with Germany. France is difficult. With Turkey, negotiate a general open diplomatic agreement with Iran. No condition. Just we have regular diplomatic relations. Period. Bring in India. Bring in the Pakistan factor, which can be done. Don't make a mess of Darfur the way some people want to do. Don't do any of these things. Don't let Egypt be destabilized. And force by getting a nice little conspiracy among some powers. We're going to shove it down the present Israeli government. We're going to have a peace, a Palestinian Israeli peace. We're going to have it. And we can do it, actually. We can do it. The danger is those nuts may go off and start throwing bombs at themselves, almost as on a suicide mission on Iran, and that could start the whole hell mess going forward. That's the situation. So they're right in their assessment of the situation. They're right in their assessment of the consequences of simple withdrawal. But when you start to define an alternative, then you find you've got a real mess on your hands. You say, well, with this president, with this vice president, with the present policies, we can't make it. So therefore, you take, on the other hand, you take the Baker-Hamilton proposal. The Baker-Hamilton proposal does touch on things which are important factors to be considered. And in that sense, it's positive. But are you willing to go enough to win the war as opposed to simply pretending to make a gesture toward winning the war? You've got to have the guts to think it through. And I believe it could be done. If I were president of the United States, I could do it. And I would do it. But I'm not president of the United States. That's your problem.
That's a problem we might be able to deal with. I'd like to call Jeff Steinberg up to the microphone to ask the next question, because I can't make it out.
Yeah, thanks, Lynn. This is a question that was sent in from Judge Carlo Palermo, who was one of the leading investigative magistrates in Italy, investigating many aspects of the whole terror campaign, strategy of tension from the 1970s through the 80s. He's now retired from his position as a magistrate, and he's a criminal lawyer, and he's involved in a case, and he asked for your insight into some of the background on the case. Basically, in April of 1991, there was a collision of two ships in the harbor of Livorno, Italy. 140 people were killed, and he's now representing the families of some of the victims. And it turns out that the reason for this collision is that this was at the tail end of the Operation Desert Storm, and the U.S. was beginning Operation Provide Comfort. Large amounts of weapons were being covertly smuggled into northern Iraq along with a number of U.S. Special Forces. This was also the period that there was a big upsurge in smuggling of weapons into the Balkans as well for the Balkan War. And Judge Palermo's question is, number one, can you shed some further insight into what was going on during that period? And secondly, would you estimate that Dick Cheney played an important role in this whole episode?
Well, Cheney was obviously key, but Cheney is not the architect of this. The policy is obvious. It's what we were concerned with, and I was concerned with back at the end of the 1970s and the beginning of the 1980s. It was what was involved in our consideration of what became known as the SDI. It was obvious that we either, with the Soviet Union at that time, we were either headed toward a unthinkable because of a crisis which was building up inside the Soviet Union already, or we were going to find some remedies. Now, the danger was that, it was typical about Reagan. Reagan had two sides. Reagan's relationship to me, especially in terms of the SDI, was one thing. And if by some chance, that if Andropov had not become the General Secretary of the Soviet Union, then I think the deal could have been made that Reagan offered, which is what I'd negotiated with the Soviet government as an offer, as a proposal. And the president presented exactly my proposal to the Soviet government. The Soviet government turned it down without discussion. And Gorbachev later did the same damn thing. Our concern was, knowing the system was going to collapse, and knowing that you could not actually fight successfully the kind of thermonuclear war which was building up, that you had to negotiate something new and induce a change in the structure of the world relations. We had the strongest support I had on this, partly from Italy, from military in Italy, from leading circles in France, and from much of the German military, who understood exactly what I was saying, that our objective was by eliminating the kind of condition which this thermonuclear confrontation represented, we could bring the factor of national power back into play again. Now, our opposition in this was always moving in the direction of the idea of globalization. So what did they do? To understand this, you've got to look at the British-French Thatcher-Mitterrand agreements on Germany to destroy Germany, which were imposed. You look at the German economy today and look at the elements of it, you find it's been destroyed. You look at the European continent, largely destroyed. Every state in the former Comecon is has far worse conditions of life than it had under the Soviet Union, except they have political freedom. The political freedom to starve and die, peacefully, maybe. So where we could have had a controlled situation, which is what the SDI represented as a strategic move from a higher level, we lost it. But you lose these idiots in the United States. The Democratic Party were a pack of idiots. The Republican Party generally were a pack of idiots and worse. And Reagan he was the only one in the leadership of the Republican Party who stuck with the SDI. Well, here am I. I'm me and Reagan. Funny kind of relationship on this thing. And I was sent to prison because of what I did in this thing. Exactly. No other reason. So therefore, once this started, once the collapse of the Soviet Union started, which none of these jerks understood was going to happen, it did happen. Then you had the Iraq War. Now, the Iraq War was orchestrated by the British and the United States, especially the British, not the United States. George, remember Thatcher saying, don't go wobbly on me, George? That's how the war got going. So we got into that. The minute we cut that off, the continuation of the war with Iraq, we went into the Balkans. Now, if you know something about European history, let's say we're starting a Balkan war. What does that mean? Now, it also was complicated because you had people like Cheney and company and their friends who are part-time murderers and part-time thieves. And once this crowd gets into an operation, you're going to get that kind of effect. The corruption, the degree of corruption, that corruption per se becomes the key decisive factor in these things. And what you're getting is you get military operations, not military, they become criminal operations. And criminal operations and military operations become indistinguishable. That's what Cheney represents. Remember, what are they going for? Don't just take power of the reaction to this or that situation. Look at this thing from above. Look at the geometry of the situation, not the mechanistic statistical patterns. Look at the geometry of the situation. What is the policy? The policy is called globalization. What is globalization? The elimination of the sovereign nation state. That's globalization. Who wants to do that? The Anglo-Dutch liberals. It's a continuation of the same thing that was called geopolitics before. Ever since Lincoln won the Civil War and the Crown Prince, Edward Albert, had to face the reality the United States had won the war against the Lord Palmerston's Confederacy. So therefore, from that time on, the danger was with the spread of the influence of the United States economic model in Germany, 1877, 1879, Japan, Russia, the same period, 1877, 1879. You had developing the spectacle, the British, Eurasia, Japan, movements in China, Russia, Germany, the new government, new government in Italy. Rumblings in France after the collapse of the crazy Napoleon III operation. Forces on the continent of Europe are following the American model. Throughout Central and South America, the American model, the U.S. model of economy, the American system of political economy is spreading its influence. So suddenly the British are now faced with the fact that their empire, which is based on maritime power, our geopolitical conception, is now threatened. And Edward Albert and his crowd, the Prince of the Isles, decided to go to World War. Another war like the Seven Years' War, which brought the British into imperial position back in the 18th century. All over again. The goal of that crowd has been the destruction of the United States, our loving ally. They embrace us, but they don't love us. They screw us, but they don't love us. That's the kind of... So this is where the problem lies. Then we have people in our own system, the traditional traitors, ever since Aaron Burr. There's a direct line since Aaron Burr of traitors to the United States. And you have people in Wall Street who are chiefly traitors, major financial interests owned by London, part of the Anglo-Dutch liberal system. They don't believe in our people. They don't believe in the lower 80% of our population. They don't believe in us as a nation. They believe us as a territory, which they want to control through their friends. It was called the White Shoe Crowd at the end of the war. When the OSS crowd came back, the people I got to know later, who were one faction of OSS, along with, Casey was part of that. Donovan was the key leader of it. Then you had the other side, the White Shoe Crowd, the Wall Street Crowd, the pro-Hitler crowd, behind Truman, behind the whole operation. So therefore, what we saw is a process of inducing the United States to adopt policies by which we destroy our own vital interests, to induce us into that kind of thing. And we, like stupid jerks under the influence of white shoe type mentalities, we go along with it. We represent not a nation as a power. That's not the essential thing to think of. We represent a principle that the best people of Europe contributed to creating on this continent a nation, a republic, which would be a model for liberating humanity as a whole from the oligarchical system. That's what we were. We were weak, we were subject to things, but that's what we are. That is our national interest. That's where our patriotism is located, not in little greedy things, but in that. To save what this nation was created to be, and not to compromise that for the sake of alliance with something. And what we had in the period, the collapse of the Soviet Union, we can play all the games we want to. And so they went to the Iraq operation first to bust that one up. Then they went into the Balkan Wars, the same way the British organized the Balkan Wars in the beginning of the last century. Same purpose, same way. So that's the only answer for the judge's question. Yeah, corruption, pure corruption. Was the United States involved? Probably. Were the British involved? Probably, in terms of that specific thing. In terms of the overall operation, they were involved. The United States was guilty. U.S. forces were involved in those operations. British forces were involved. French forces were involved. And they were corrupt. They were rotten. And by my approach to this thing is I don't know how we can win cases in isolation. On the Italian case, like Judge Palermo, Italy, we have some very interesting developments right now, which is a result of the work I did earlier on the idea of developing a new Bretton Woods policy for Italy. The new Bretton Woods policy comes up now as the present government of Italy is on the verge of toppling. And so some of the forces of the other government have picked up again on the new Bretton Woods policy, which I laid out and they adopted in Italy. So you may find that Italy becomes a factor. Under those conditions, then what Judge Palermo is talking about may become an active possibility from the standpoint of Italian jurisprudence and government. But that's the way to look at it. Can we get a struggle for the nation state, agreement on the defense of the nation state against globalization, against the Anglo-Dutch liberals in our own country as well as in Europe? Can we get that? If we can get that, we can clean the mess up. But I don't think we can clean the mess up unless we can do that, because right up to now, the enemy has been winning.
Interestingly, we have a lot of questions that are coming in from Italy, including from a group of young boys in Ascoli Piceno, but we will get to those. Lynn, I want to switch to some questions concerning the U.S. economy that are coming in from members of the professional staff of various congressional offices and committees who, after 12 years of having been the minority party, are now finding that they have to draft policies, and they are having some problems. And they want your help. And judging from these questions, they really need your help. The first question, I won't go through all of them because they're all kind of similar, but I'm kind of synopsizing some of them. This is a question that came in from somebody who is a staffer on a number of different committees, but most specifically on the Senate Democratic Policy Committee. And she says, Mr. LaRouche, you've often pointed to JFK's mobilization to put a man on the moon as a historic model or precedent for the kind of mobilization that we need today to rebuild our nation's decaying infrastructure. But in Kennedy's day, we were in much better shape as a nation. And the mission itself was defined in terms that seem relatively narrow by comparison to what we face today. As I understand it, the problem today is different. If former Treasury Secretary Rubin is correct, we don't even have enough cash to cover the most basic commitment that the government has made to its citizens. So how on earth can we begin to adequately address the actual needs of an increasingly impoverished population without massively increasing the federal deficit, which we obviously don't want to do?
Well, first of all, I got some areas where to reversing some tax cuts, and particularly in the upper 3% of family income brackets. I think we should melt down some of those golden parachutes. No, the point is, this is a totally immoral swindle, and we have to understand that that's the nature of the thing. Secondly, if you don't make a change, which is what I addressed today, if you don't make a change in the structure of the international monetary system of the type I outlined today, there's not a damn thing you can do. So either do it my way or be damned. Because what I propose will work is based on principles which were tested, in a sense, under Roosevelt. They're traditional for us. They are based on concepts which are understood. And it's only that we are enslaved to a... We're like brainwashed zombies as a nation. We believe in economic liberalism. Anybody who believes in economic liberalism has to be brainwashed. They should be put under protection. They should not be allowed to print or have money. We have to go back to the principles of the American system. That means we have to reorganize the world monetary financial system. How can we do it? Easy. Put me in the right position in the United States. I don't even have to be president. All you have to do is take my orders. And I can guarantee you, I know exactly what to do, which will work, given support. And it will work, why? Because the world is going to become suddenly panicked. And they're going to say, somebody, anybody, please do something. And that's the only way you can do this. It's when they scream, somebody, anybody, help us. We'll accept anything, help us. Then you can come in with a calm voice, make a proposal and say, well, you can do this. But you don't want to do that. Okay, then go to hell. Under those conditions, history has proven time and time again that that's the way you act. Look, real leaders and architects in history have always functioned on this basis. You're working in terms of cycles which are like astronomical cycles. You don't know how long they are, but you know that's the nature of the situation. You know that sooner or later, the system that you have is not going to work. And it's not going to work means you're going to come to a point of crisis where everybody's going to scream, it doesn't work, what are you going to do? Save us, save us, save us. Now that's a dangerous point. You can either get a remedy or you can get a dictatorship or wars at that point. So the point is you have to have people who beforehand have understood what has to be done and are ready to do it. The idiot says, but we can't propose that because they're not ready to do it. Say, you damn idiot, don't you realize that's history? You prepare to do something that has to be done, and you never say it can't be done because they're not ready to do it. You wait until they're damn good and ready. When history kicks them in the ass. And that's how you do it. Look, those of us who have fought, as I have fought, we don't give up. We're right. We know we're right. We keep at it. And we wait for the time that comes when what we're proposing will be accepted. And if it takes time, that's all right. Because what can we do about it? There's nothing we can do about it. You can't artificially change history. You provide ideas. Some ideas will creep ahead and independently of you and go ahead, go forward. But at the same time, you know that you're coming to a point where decisions are going to have to be made. You base yourself on preparing yourself and others for that decision, which is the only solution. The problem is the nervous Nelly, like the coward in warfare, the nervous Nelly who says, we're losing the war. We've got to make a deal with the enemy now. The coward. And therefore, if you're not a coward and you have the right policy, stick to it. If you don't win right away, stick to it, because it's the right policy. That's the only way to look at it. So we can do it. I prescribe what has to be done today. Again, it's brief, but it contains the core of the argument. The theory of money is crazy. Our policies are crazy. We are already bankrupt. The system is coming down. There's no way within this system in its current bankrupt state that you can, within the system, as presently prescribed, save this nation. Are you prepared to save the nation? Are you prepared to give up your illusions to save this nation? Or are you going to choose to go to hell for the sake of ideas that don't work? That's leadership.
Okay. This is another question like this. This is from a group of fellows at the Hamilton Project, with one speaking on behalf of the other four. He says, "Mr. LaRouche, I've studied your work for quite some time, and I've never had any argument with your critiques of both the U.S. and the global financial systems. The problem I have now, though, is that I just cannot seem to wrap my brain around what you're saying has to be done, or rather, how it can be done. The fact is that as a nation, we are bankrupt, plain and simple. You say that the government can create long-term credit earmarked to rebuild the nation's infrastructure. I do understand that once something like that is underway, that a mobilization like that would boost employment and therefore increase the tax base, yada, yada, yada. What I don't understand is the first step. If a bankrupt government can create credit out of nothing, then why can't any third world nation do essentially the same thing to rebuild or to initiate building of their own national infrastructure?"
Well, the fact is they can't. The United States can. Because the system is denominated in dollars. This is a dollar system. The world system is a dollar monetary system. The world monetary system is about to collapse. The Chinese are not stupid. The Chinese know that if the dollar collapses, the Chinese economy goes into a crisis. Other countries are intelligent to know that. Maybe not the British, or maybe not some other people like that. But that's a fact. And in this situation, you've got to give up all mechanistic, statistical ideas, statistical chain reactions. Forget them. What you have to do is change the architecture of the system. Your objection is you're trying to find a way in which what I propose might be introduced into the system. It can't be introduced into the system, because it challenges the essential assumptions, the axiomatic assumptions, upon which the system is based. I'm saying change the system. Put the system. Have the federal government, the first step is not to start coming up with some program for investment. First of all, you've got to have a system under which you can do that. How do you do it? The federal government it's astonished. We have just discovered the entire banking system is bankrupt, which it already is. All they have to do is announce they have discovered that fact. Once you announce you've discovered that fact, then you say, what do we do? The first thing you have to do before discussing my proposals, you have to follow my proposals in the right order. First of all, number one, the entire U.S. banking system is hopelessly bankrupt. Number one, get the point? Them is bankrupt. Number two, the federal government must acknowledge this fact. Now, acknowledging this fact under the Constitution, under the preamble of the Constitution, which is the fundamental law of the Constitution, the general welfare. Then, in the defense of the general welfare, which can be defended efficiently in no other way, because a chaotic disintegration of the banking system is not acceptable, the general welfare. Therefore, we must act to defeat the disintegration of the banking system. Well, how do you defend the banking system when it's bankrupt? Elementary, John Watson. You put the bankrupt system into bankruptcy protection. How do you do that? The federal government simply, as in one statement by the President of the United States, declares the Federal Reserve System bankrupt and takes it into receivership for protection and management. Right? Then we decide, under bankruptcy arrangements, how we deal with this bankrupt mess. We've taken it over. We have assigned, some accounts have to be postponed. Some have to be canceled. The golden parachutes just went out, just got holes in them. They're canceled. Because the golden parachutes involve assets lodged in banks. The discretion of the bankrupting agency is to find the protection comes into play. It may be an argument, a big fight about it, but that's where you are. So now what you do is you now, what do you do in a bankruptcy? You convert short-term obligations into long-term obligations. That's what you do in a bankruptcy. You write off part of the claims is what you do in a bankruptcy. And they don't have much choice but to consent to something like that. They can argue about the equity of this against that, but we're in the situation. Look, buddy, you ran the system. You, the Federal Reserve System and the member banks, you ran the system. You created the bankruptcy. Yeah, the federal government was complicit, but we got rid of them. We got rid of the ones who did it, like Alan Greenspan. We got rid of them. Now we're cleaning up the mess this bunch of crooks created. We're now going to defend the United States. And defending the United States means defending his people. Defending his people from starvation, from a breakdown of healthcare systems, things like that. We're going to do it. The whole world has to do the same thing. Europe has to do exactly the same thing. We're going to do it. Now what do we got? We've got one thing. We've got a tradition, and we've got certain skills still left, as Western Europe does. We're going to use those skills. We're going to rebuild ourselves for the biggest world market there is. And the biggest world market there is poor countries in poor regions of the world where the populations are desperately poor who need the benefits of modern technology, including basic economic infrastructure. So we're now going to hawk ourselves to agree to supply to those countries the assistance they need in capital formation to build up their economies. We're going to extend credit that is our promissory note, our promise to produce for the next period of 25 to 50 years. Now, we're going to say, under this agreement to other nations, let's do the same thing among ourselves as nations. Let's get ourselves a few big ones to join with us. And we say, let's recreate the Bretton Woods system in principle, but in a new form, upon terms defined by present conditions. See, it's a matter of political will. It's a matter of understanding what conditions that exist have to be changed. It's seeing the situation in a different way. Not trying to define a, you know, sneaking in with a little proposal, shoving a piece of paper under a door, suggestion, and hoping that somehow it'll fly in the morning. If you're going to do this kind of thing, you come in from the top. The top is the United States, still, because it's our dollar. Not really ours anymore, but it's denominated in U.S. dollars. The ability, the promise of the United States government to pay against the dollar, that's our power. Therefore, we exert that power to force a reorganization of the world international financial monetary system. What we do essentially is we put the Anglo-Dutch liberal bankers out of political power. And we do so. And we do that by making agreements with nations on a nation-to-nation basis or group of nations basis that we have to reorganize this world because the way it's been run by these international financier interests has ruined the world. This is the syphilis of the world, liberalism. And syphilis has been liberally distributed. And the time has come, we have to make a general reform in policy under which we declare that liberalism is now outlawed. It's a disease. We have to create an equitable system, which is equitable to governments, equitable among people as human beings. And we have to subordinate any other claims on government to that principle. We go to the same principle which is stated in the preamble of the U.S. Federal Constitution, the principle of the general welfare, essentially. We say on the basis of that constitutional principle, which is ours, and on the basis of the power we represent, even for purposes of default, that should be the ruling principle among nations, that we agree to that, and that we make agreements covering 25 to 50 years in the future based on that agreement. We reconstruct and rebuild a brand new international monetary financial system and put the other rest old system into bankruptcy reorganization. We then treat the process of treating this in bankruptcy equitably. The first thing we care about is people. Next thing we care about is the kind of institutions, the productive institutions, which are necessary to meet the obligation to people. We operate on the basis of justice for people, to take people in poor parts of the world who are suffering and say they have a claim against us for us to assist them. We think about our nation from the standpoint of what people 3 generations from now or 2 generations from now will think about the United States because of what we have done today. And that is our security, not our muscle power. The great power, the greatest political power, the greatest power on this planet is the power to do good.
Prior to today's webcast, a number of people commented that Lynn's webcasts, especially webcasts that he's done pre and post-election, have just an incredible record in terms of bringing about rapid change. And, I'm generally not a superstitious person. I think your speech killed Milton Friedman. It's true. Milton Friedman died today. I think that may be a harbinger of good things to come. Well, we were talking about syphilis, so I thought I could bring it up. Okay. We're going to move away from Washington for a moment because a congressman from Mexico has submitted a question. Lynn, this is from Congressman Roberto Mendoza. He is a deputy from the PRD for the state of Tabasco, where things are hot. I'm sorry, I couldn't resist. He says, Mr. LaRouche, how do you think the Congress of Mexico could participate in the economic change which you are proposing nationally and internationally?
I've just been taking some pills for something. I get a little unsteady with that. I think the first thing is to say, what should we do? Not how could Mexico participate, but what should we do? The first thing we always think about is how we in the United States present ourselves to other countries, especially our neighboring countries. For example, we have the crucial issue right now is the piece of idiocy, which is this border legislation, U.S. and Mexico. Now, we have people from Mexican or other points south who come up through Mexico into the United States. It involves a number of generations of different categories, people who have been here for several generations, but still identify themselves with the Spanish language and with relatives left back, for example, in Mexico. Those who have come more recently, who are more inclined to have more important ties to relatives in Mexico. You have, for example, whole states of Mexico in which the population depends upon remittances from relatives in the United States. The whole state depends upon remittances from the United States, from their relatives. Then you have people who have come in as illegals, and this is encouraged by certain forces in the United States, which wants the cheap labor. This is a big problem in California. It runs through Texas to Chicago, for example. All right, and they of course have many relatives. Well, we know of cases where people run drugs so the drug runners will sneak them across the border. They're not drug runners themselves, but they will carry drugs in hope that they're carrying that one piece of loot will get them across the border. You have sections of Mexico which are run by private armies. Such whole sections of territories of Mexican states are not under control of the state or the federal government of Mexico. They're private armies, sometimes recruited from the Mexican army or from security forces, are working with others and running things like the Colombian gangs in Mexico, and they, near the border, are key in the smuggling across the border. If you wanted to eliminate the smuggling, you would go down and do two things. One of the things you would do is you go down to get those guys out by cooperating with the Mexican government to shut them down. And our muscle would back up the Mexican government in that by methods which are appropriate without breaching their sovereignty. So the point is well, you've got this situation. You've got the minority in the United States, the largest single designated minority, cultural minority, is Hispanic. Most of it's associated with Mexico. This is a big part of our citizenry. It's larger than the African American minority. So therefore, you're dealing essentially with the general welfare question in terms of what the Bush administration has done with this problem, which is a problem. What it's done is the worst possible thing in the world. So stop it. Bush's friends wanted Mexican cheap labor across the border into Texas. They wanted it. Other people, governors, political organizations wanted it. Now you want to pick on these poor people who came over out of desperation because what we did to Mexico since 1982, we destroyed Mexico's ability to develop. We looted it. We shut it down. Now these people are desperate for jobs, they're desperate for incomes, they're coming across the U.S. border because they can't get jobs in Mexico. Whole communities depend upon this system. This is rank injustice. This is a criminal kind of injustice. A lack of care for a nation which is our nearest neighbor in this respect. And this holier than thou, we're going to defend our borders. We have to defend our borders against what has infested the White House.
Next question comes from a senior Senate staffer, but we have just an incredible number of questions on this topic. So I thought I should ask you to address it. Says Mr. LaRouche, because the Democrats won a majority, this has gotten very little public attention. But the fact is that this election was rife with voter suppression, outright vote fraud, and a whole host of other dirty tricks, all perpetrated by the GOP. One of the things that this particular person brought up in particular were these robocalls that went on. But what the question is how do you think this should be addressed? Do you think that Congress should hold hearings on these actions, and should these crimes be prosecuted, or should we just brush them away because we managed to win a majority?
Well, isn't robocall spam?
Yes.
Don't we have legislation on that? Why don't we apply it? The crime has been committed. Why don't we enforce it? You have to have a multifarious approach to this thing to realize that there's a systemic problem which takes many forms. You look at what you have in terms of legislation, which is on the books, institutional practices on the books, and you use the normal institutional practices on the books if you think they're just, and you use them to deal with the problem. You undercut it. If you undercut it, you will find some people who will be encouraged, panting at your door, ready to confess. Yeah, I'll confess if you'll get me out of this. So just go at it with a straight law enforcement attitude, that kind of attitude. It obviously is a criminality. It has to be known as criminality. It's subversion of justice. It's a subversion of our government. It's the destruction of our sovereignty. And the integrity of the ballot is extremely important. The right to vote and the integrity of the ballot. And the integrity against pollution of the ballot by fake votes or by fraudulent methods of inducing people to vote, which is not of their own free will. So therefore, every measure which is possible on the books and such additional measures and legislation as might be needed should be simply put to work as a package and get this thing cleaned up. Now, usually it happens that this goes over a period of an electoral period. They go through these electoral cycles. So it's tough to clean these out under present procedures. So we need clarification on general legislation which realizes this is a national emergency and expedites the procedures which are needed to clean the mess up. So put them in the jug. Little brown jug.
Next question is from Jason Pintar from Democracy Now. Mr. LaRouche, over the last 10 days, we've spent a lot of time discussing what the new Democratic Congress should do, and that discussion will obviously continue. But the one thing that we've not discussed is what the other side will do. I'm actually somewhat optimistic about the Congress, because although the Democrats don't have a veto-proof majority, the general mood of the population has not gone unnoticed by a good number of Republican members. And the White House's ability to maintain strict party discipline, as they have in the past, is likely to suffer greatly. I'm more concerned, however, about what the administration will try to do, especially between now and the swearing in of the new Congress. And I'm sure that you are, too. I know that you do not have a crystal ball, but I was wondering if you could discuss specifically what you expect they may try to do and how you think we can respond to it in advance.
Well, the first thing to do is to do something which I referred to today and put some emphasis on it here, is that the problem of the United States is not that it's the number one evil in the world. That is the blackmail. That's the problem, the myth. The United States is the victim of the Anglo-Dutch liberal system, whose goal is a form of imperialism called globalization. What has been done largely through those Anglo-Dutch liberal interests inside and outside the United States is to impose upon us a couple of fools, a Laurel and Hardy team called Bush and Cheney. One guy does the slugging, the other guy does the screaming. You have a congenital idiot and a thug who are being deployed to discredit and destroy the United States from within. Now, once it is made clear that that is the case, then you break the back of Republicans' commitment to be party loyal in this matter. See, the one thing, you've got some Republicans who are not human. You've got a couple of Democrats who also are not human. I know that very well. I know some of them personally. And I watch them on all six legs, and I realize they're not human. So the key thing here is to start from the top. What's the problem? That the evil which our nation is credited with creating is not our evil. It's something we had took into the house that we should have kept out of the door. A foreign influence which induced us. Look, how was this done? You can't blame the Republicans if you don't take into account you had a Gore-Lieberman ticket in the 2000. You had a president, Bill Clinton, who was the most popular president that ever walked since Roosevelt, practically, or Kennedy at least. And he had a successor. And he drowned what should have been an easy victory over a congenital idiot. He drowned it in Gore, who is still doing idiotic things today. I mean, Gore and his wife, Tipper, are not exactly the brightest bulbs in creation. So if we have to understand what Gore did, Gore has brought in imported policies which are absolutely insane and un-American. And if you think this nation has a responsibility and a mission, a duty of honor to itself and to the world to be what we're supposed to be, then you have to realize that there are certain influences in politics which should be recognized for what they are. And the first thing you do is you talk about it. The worst thing you can have is a sacred cow or a white elephant. In other words, the way you could ruin the old days in Asia, you could ruin your rival by giving it a white elephant, and it would have to feed this thing and care for it and so forth. It'd bankrupt the Raja by getting this white elephant as a gift. And we have white elephants. George Bush is a white elephant. He insists that he's white. And you have Al Gore, who does not quite sure what his species is, but it's pretty much the same thing. So why can't we say how, as I did, what a ridiculous menace this Gore was? And I was not too popular with a guy called Podesta and so forth because I said so. And I wrote a profile and published it, which was intended for the edification of the Clinton administration, that this guy is a damned menace. And it was Gal Gore who picked up this creature, this fascist, running around as a Republican, a Buckley fascist, working with the Cuban gangs, who I knew from the time when I was down in Cuba, and you had these gamblers, these gangsters, who were running the country under Batista. And they became called freedom fighters in the United States, in Florida. And this is where Lieberman went for support, and he got the support from a certifiable fascist, Buckley, the Buckley family. How does somebody call this a Democrat? We'd be calling a six-legged monster a Democrat the next thing you know. So anyway, so these cases, the problem is public opinion. You can't say that about him. He's a public figure. He's respectable. Well, if he get rid of two of those legs, I think we might be more less unrespectable. So the problem starts right there, is that we become total hypocrites. We become sophists. And we don't call things by the right name. We also, in particular, do not recognize. I mean, you don't go around having people deprived of rights because they're traitors or stinking or stupid. But what you do is you simply identify them truthfully for what they are. You don't abuse them. You don't libel them. because you don't like them, but you tell the truth about them. And when you're going to attack somebody, be very careful about telling the truth so you don't have the guilt of perpetrating an injustice in the process of doing so. But when the guy is a skunk, you point to the white stripe.
Then the next question comes from Ira Hirschhorn from the ACLU. He says, Mr. LaRouche, during the electoral campaign, your organization exposed a widespread homogenization operation on U.S. campuses that would have made the Nazis proud. Not surprisingly, we learned that the wife of the vice president in charge of torture was the Wicked Witch who presided over the effort. Can you say more about this? Will your organization continue its work to expose this operation? And do you think that there are potential constitutional violations involved?
Well, there are simple human rights violations involved in the attempt of this bunch of thugs using thuggish methods to enforce it. We've had some discussion about this matter, of how we approach it, and particularly with the youth trying to deal with it. And therefore, we find that when we get smart, we find a better way of exposing it than simply the simplistic approach. But the point is, our intention is to destroy it. Look, this is a Nazi force. It's the equivalent of it. It would make Goebbels would love it. It's a Goebbels type of Nazi thing. It may not be. It is Nazi, actually, the people behind it. When you look at the Ayn Rand crowd, these are real Nazis. Same thing. But it's not that they're Nazi essence. There are certain forms which may appear in different colors and different costumes. Nazi, fascist, this or that. But which are essentially the same thing. And they represent an attempt to tyrannize a population. You have this, for example, in German universities. Most of the German universities have an SS equivalent or staff, thug bunch on the university campus, which is an enforcement agency. The suppression of ideas in institutions which are supposed to deal with the ideas. And this is used as a political weapon. These are organized thuggery on university campuses in Germany. We have a different form in the United States, which is this form. And this form all goes back to Buckley. It goes to Lieberman. Remember, Lieberman was part of the operation. And he's actually a Republican. You look at count the votes that he got in Connecticut that got him reelected as a Democrat. They were Republican votes. The Republican Party gave up his votes and dumped its own candidate to elect Lieberman so it could control the... And the intent, of course, is to have Lieberman run as the vice presidential candidate for McCain. So this is sort of a new caricature version. You know, it's like a Hollywood remake of Laurel and Hardy or something. Or of Bush and Cheney. That Lieberman will be the Cheney of the next administration. And McCain will be the ranting and raving guy. And Lieberman will be the thug, organize the hitmen. He won't go out and make thuggish statements. He'll be Mr. Sweet Pie. But he will organize and order the hits. While McCain's up there ranting and raving, going to kill this guy, we're going to kill that guy. You can imagine, that's what they have in store for us. So therefore, we do have to recognize, however, that there is a force. We know what it is. It's the same thing as the Nazis. It's in our country. It's in South America. It comes from the Nazis. Directly. Buckley is that, exactly. The Buckley crowd. And they're in this area, around Washington. We do the same thing around here. We've run into them. We've run into them into Europe. Now, sure, we are out. This is a proper thing for the ACLU to be concerned about. Because the liberties of Americans are in jeopardy. And you look at how Hitler came to power, how it was orchestrated, and you say, this is the kind of thing. We've got to do a better job than the Germans did, or we'll find a Hitler here.
as is always the case at these events, we have far more questions than we will have time to ask. It's been called to my attention that we're coming very close to the end of the time that we have. And it is also the case that many of the questions that have been submitted are questions that Lynn has already answered. I will pass on to him, as we always do, questions that we just couldn't get to. But I'd like to end with a question which was submitted by a group of young boys from Ascoli Piceno in Italy. And their question has aspects of it which are specific to Italy, but I think that it's a fitting question to end with, because it does raise kind of a universal question that's reflected in many of the questions that have been submitted by young people who are listening to this webcast, including some who are sitting here. It says, "Dear Mr. LaRouche, we're a group of young boys from Ascoli Piceno, and we'd like to ask you, why do you think that in Italy, as well as in other places, there is such a complete lack of search for truth? We see it here in the media, not only in the media controlled by Berlusconi, but really throughout the entire political class, not to mention among economists. The question that we have is what could a common citizen do to actually help its nation regain a pivotal role in a new world renaissance? For instance, how could any individual citizen acquire a real and full knowledge of the political and economic facts? How could an individual search for truth, especially when they find themselves in a position, as we do, of living in a small provincial town?"
Yes, Ascoli Piceno. Quite familiar with the place. It has its own problems. But the key problem in Italy has been that Italy did get, under exceptional circumstances, including the friends of Betti in science, went through a brilliant development in northern Italy, around the circles of Betti, which were also the close friends of Riemann. This was the Italian aerospace program. It was many things in Italy were developed around this group of people. But then on the same time, you see the other side of Italy, and all the great things Italy used to do has been shut down now. Instead of having factories in Milan, you have poor, naked, starved girls wearing stinking rags, parading as a, you know, in the fashion industry of Italy. And the point is they're so skinny that the skin is inside the bones. And they rattle as they walk. I don't recommend that ladies be fat, but I think they should be sort of normal. So anyway, you have this instead of the science-related things around Milan, for example. Then I go, when I visited several times in Florence, and I'm looking at these objects, these things, the history of Florence, and looking at the work of Brunelleschi, for example, who was the first to develop the application of the catenary as a physical design feature in building the cupola of the famous cathedral. I get involved with this with scientists in that period, and I look at this and I say, "This is it, this is it, this is the catenary, this is why this thing." Yeah, he says, "Yes, yes, yes." Right? All this wonderful artwork which comes out of there. But then you look at the population of Florence. Disaster. Cultural disaster. But then you look at another thing, which hit me hard, that I was very much concerned in the 1970s, especially the early 70s, with what was called the Casa di Mezzogiorno, because Italy was divided into two parts, the north and the south. And Italy was never one nation, because the countries to the south, what we call the Mezzogiorno, the twilight area, were never developed. Desperation, mass insanity in places like... actually whole communities, Calabria, for example, mass insanity in cities. It's like an epidemic disease, like a fatal epidemic disease. And the whole idea of the Casa di Mezzogiorno, which was to develop, integrate Italy so that the people of the southern part of Italy would be part of the same country as the people of the northern part of Italy. This was shut down. Cultural warfare, everything was done to destroy the potential of the Italian population, which included some very great intellectual talent, despite the decadence which went through like many other parts of Europe. And to me, I would think that the very crisis we have in Europe as well as the rest of the world, the hopelessness of the situation under present policies, would inspire young people to think of themselves as a generation who will lead the older generation to make the necessary reforms. I do not think that the older generation, the baby boomer generation, or even people 50 and over, so forth, I don't think that they'll do it. I don't think it's in them anymore. I think they're broken. Unless younger Italians in the 18 to 35 age group pick up the baton and start to do the kinds of things that we're trying to do from the standpoint of the youth movement here in the United States and to some degree in some parts, other parts of Europe. That's the only solution. You've got to mobilize a revolutionary force, which doesn't mean violence, but it means to make a fundamental change in policy. And you've got to bring forth in Italy a concerted group of people, young people, who will do in Italy what we're trying to do with the youth movement in the United States. And we've got to do what we do, what we're doing with the Kepler projects and similar projects. You've got to do that, because you've got to build this around a competent scientific foundation and also a musical competent musical foundation. Because music is the only medium in which we have some degree of control, as you do not over acting. We're trying to do something with acting, including with some professional actors. But the music gives you a control in terms of meeting the standard of the composer's intention, which you do not get in any other form of art. And therefore, by getting people to, at the same time, master the conceptions of scientific principle while matching, by Bach and so forth, by actually learning what this means, you get the kind of personality which has the confidence of certainty of knowledge, which gives them the confidence to make revolutions of one kind or another. And we need to see that in Italy, as in other parts of the world. It's the only hope. The only hope lies with new generations who will lead and get the world out of the rut, and who will inspire people from older generations still living to join them in the cause. The older generation will not initiate the effort, but many of them will be inspired by the example of the younger generation. And that's the only solution.
Well, I think so far we've done a good job. But we have a lot of work to do. And I think that today, without question, Lynn gave us the tools and the weapons that we need to get that job done. It would also help for those of you who are listening on the internet, if you took the opportunity, since it is becoming very close to the calendar year, you can max out your contribution to LPAC, which will do a great deal to support the brilliant work that this youth movement is doing under Mr. LaRouche's direction. But we can certainly talk more about that later. Right now, I'd like all of you to join me in thanking Lynn for this historic event.
What did we do?
Will members of the LaRouche Youth Movement please convene outside? Your leaders have something to tell you, I think.